listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. We just heard from Pulp, their song Tomorrow Never Lies. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to get a little bit into the a little more into the specific institutions that I see as being part of this federation of socialist republics that I am seeking to create, which is what the Universal Republic is. Once again, we're talking about my book, Proletarian God, Building the Socialist Future. And in this case, we're talking about the institutions that will make up that socialist future. What I really want to talk about here is the really pivotal institution, really the foundation of the system of governments I'm talking about here, is the Proletarian Guard. This institution really is the foundation of the Universal Republic. This institution will be responsible for prosecuting the global struggle against capitalism and all forms of exploitation, in the building of socialism in all lands, and unifying the diverse nations of the world in a universal commonwealth. Universal socialist commonwealth. This institution consists, the Proletarian Guard consists of the armed and mobilized citizenry of the proletarian republics engaged in the democratic governance of their communities, regions, and nations, empowered politically, culturally, economically, and socially. The power of the proletarian commonwealth lies with the people, and it is through the democratic power of the people that the worldwide socialist revolution will achieve ultimate victory. The Proletarian Guard will form the legislative branch of the government of the Universal Republic, as well as the basis of executive and judicial governance. Socialist revolution and working class struggle depends on the raising of class consciousness among working people and the maintenance and extension of this class consciousness throughout the population, across borders and around the world. Above all, the socialist state, the proletarian republic, and certainly any federation of proletarian republics will require the direct service and direct participation of all its citizens in public affairs. Bluntly put, proletarians with a real class consciousness and a direct stake in a functioning socialist society and community do not become dupes for the CIA. This participation must include such things as political decision-making in self-governing communities, the election of representatives for regional and national governments, the policing of communities, the defense of communities, the health and safety of communities, in the education of communities, the upbringing of children, and the direction of the communal economy. The Proletarian Republic requires the full engagement and mobilization of the people if it is to be successful in ultimately making the transition to communism. Collective responsibility and collective solidarity must always be maintained for free individuals and free peoples to remain free and liberated from the shackles of class oppression and exploitation. Proletarian citizens must be fully engaged. The education systems of our proletarian republics will not only train educated citizens, but dedicated revolutionary soldiers, fully conscious of their class, their history, and ready to do their part in the struggle for human liberation. The purpose of the single-party socialist state that was established in the young Soviet Union in 1921 was to unite and mobilize the people in the construction of socialism, as well as for the defense of revolution from both domestic and foreign enemies. Instead of embracing a culture of political competition between multiple parties that would tend to undermine working-class solidarity by attempting to find and to magnify issues with which to provoke and aggravate discontent in order to attempt to win, socialist politics would be based on a single mass party that was rooted in the working class and the peasantry, and which existed to transmit their sentiments and address their concerns, transforming them into concrete slogans, programs, and policies. The Universal Republic will likewise require a single mass line, a united democratic consciousness expressed through the proletarian institutions. The Proletarian Guard is the foundation of the Republic, its anchor, and its surest defense against counter-revolution. Fundamentally, the proletarian citizen does not exist without economic power. A political voice is meaningless without power over the means of production on the part of working people. Without economic control by the people, the despot will reign in every workplace and will inevitably dominate the political establishment as well. Economic power always underpins political authority. Unless the people hold economic power and control the means of production in society, then there will be no democracy and citizenship will be an empty word. Real democracy demands socialism. To this end, economic planning must exist at every level of the Universal Republic, as working people decide through democratic participation what the economic priorities of their communities, regions, and nations should be. Economic planning in every proletarian republic will be inseparable from the political process. Under socialism, the working class controls the means of production, and as such, all economic enterprises in every commune, in every region, in every proletarian republic will be under the democratic direction and governance of the proletarian guard as the embodiment of working class power. In such a cooperative system of socialist production and collective labor, information and resources will be freely shared for the common good of all without the constraints of capitalist copyright law. Specialized expertise in certain industries and fields of development existing within certain republics will be disseminated and shared so that the other, less developed republics may upgrade their capacities. Socialism demands the shared prosperity of all peoples, and the economic system of the Universal Republic must guarantee the free development of all peoples within the Federation. Proletarian citizens must also be trained to oppose the physical might, the physical threat that existing capitalism poses to revolutionary societies, a truth that Cuba, one of the most enduring socialist nations, has integrated into its doctrine of defense. The proletarian guard is ultimately a reflection of the Cuban Committees for the Defense of the Revolution, which involves the vast majority of the Cuban population in the defense of socialism. As Fidel Castro said in September 1960, when Cuba was facing a very real threat of invasion by the United States, as well as daily acts of terrorism by CIA-backed saboteurs, quote, "The imperialists and their lackeys will not be able to make a move. They are dealing with the people, and they do not know yet the tremendous revolutionary power of the people. Therefore, new steps must be taken in the organization of the militia. Militia battalions will be created throughout Cuba. A man for each weapon will be selected. A structure will be given to the entire mass of militiamen so that as soon as possible, our combat units will be perfectly formed and trained." The military aspect of the proletarian guard is a crucial one in light of the colossal threats to the survival of any working-class revolution in the modern world. Every able-bodied citizen of the Republic will receive military training as a right of citizenship and continue to participate in such trainings and military exercises throughout their adult lives as members of their commune. Each commune will be responsible for providing military unit for service in the defense of the Republic in time of war. Thus, every adult citizen will be a part-time soldier, and the standing armed forces of the Universal Republic will not be separate from the proletarian guard, but will simply serve as a professional corps of soldiers that can then lend its expertise to the guard as a whole. The military capacity of the proletarian guard within each local commune will be divided into four echelons. The first echelon will consist of the members of the guard placed at the highest stage of combat readiness, and who are prepared to mobilize rapidly in the face of any crisis situation. The second echelon will consist of a reserve formation that can be quickly mobilized in support of the first echelon should the situation demand it. The third echelon will consist of another reserve formation that can be called upon in times of serious crisis. And the fourth echelon will consist of the least combat-ready elements of the guard and will only be mobilized in the direst extremity of total war. Each echelon will comprise approximately 25% of the men and women of military age within any given commune. The first echelon will serve another purpose as well. This echelon will consist of members of the guard who have volunteered to be at the highest level of combat readiness and as such will likely be made up of its most ideologically committed and loyal members in each commune. If a commune becomes corrupted by counter-revolutionary or reactionary forces, its first echelon should remain loyal to the communist cause and be capable of mounting effective resistance. As Lenin said, The Revolutionary Army is needed because great historical questions can only be solved by violence. And whether a situation demands violence or not, the Revolutionary Army must always stand ready. The final role played by the volunteers of the first echelon is to provide a direct link between the different branches of socialist governance through leadership, education, and example. All new members of the Universalist Order and Judicator Order will be recruited from the first echelon of the Proletarian Guard, and each first echelon volunteer must swear allegiance to the working class and pledge service to the socialist cause unto death, upholding the duties of their position within their respective communities and beyond. We are well aware of the enemy's policy of fomenting coups and turning military intelligence and other armed agencies of the state against socialist leaders and movements. This is why the Proletarian Guard closely integrates all forces of the socialist state with the popular institutions of socialist governance, to the point where they are inseparable and no rogue elements can emerge. This is the only way to make the socialist state secure. The period of socialism is by definition a period of war, militarily, economically, politically, and culturally, as the forces of the international proletariat clash with the forces of capitalism on a global scale. The executive and judicial leadership of the Proletarian Guard will consist of those citizens who have freely chosen to dedicate their lives to the building of socialism and the prosecution of the class struggle against capitalism. As such, the executive and judiciary of the Universal Republic will be subordinate to the Proletarian Guard and will not function as separate entities, which would have the potential of being corrupted by the class enemy. Every army must have its command staff, its captains and commanders, and the Proletarian Guard is no exception. The executive authority of the Universal Republic is the Universalist Order, the international vanguard of socialist revolution made up of a body of professional revolutionaries, advocates, agitators, administrators, and soldiers who have dedicated their lives to the cause of socialism and the coordination of all efforts to ensure its construction throughout the world. They will be the international guardians of the proletariat, responsible for defending the gains of revolution and forcefully expanding them until all forms of class exploitation lie shattered. They are the proletarian general staff in the class war. The Universalist Order will be responsible for the planning, coordination, and leadership of the proletarian struggle as it advances towards communism. The judicial authority of the Universal Republic is the Judicator Order, the international body of revolutionary judges responsible for the enforcement of socialist law and for the upholding of socialist justice. The persistence of systems of class exploitation in the modern world has created large numbers of criminals and parasites in need of prosecution, and countless injustices in need of redress and restitution. This will be the task of the judicators, who will constitute a revolutionary vanguard of a different type. While the Proletarian Guard must and will be the very embodiment of participatory democracy as a vehicle for defending and advancing the interests of the working class, the Universalist Order will function differently. Hostile circumstances demand that the revolutionary vanguard, as the command section of the socialist state, must function as a modified military junta upon seizing power. As the professional general staff of the socialist revolution, the Universalist Order will retain the unified command structure of an army, as befits its international role in directing the global war effort against capitalism. The nature of this role means that it cannot be subject to elections and must instead appoint its leaders based on a standardized system of merit, experience, and accomplishment. This standardized process of selection and advancement within the Universalist Order's organizational structure will be indispensable because the order is a global entity and not tied to any particular nation. Unlike the Proletarian Guard, it has no electoral base. The Universalist Order will be a universal organization, coordinating the resources and armies of the proletariat in the class struggle hand in hand with the representatives of the Proletarian Guard. While not subject to accountability through elections, the order's power will be checked by the overwhelming strength of the armed and politically engaged proletariat. That will be more than capable of checking and disciplining any abuse of power. In addition, the presence of a separate judicator order of revolutionary judges and law enforcers will ensure that justice is meted out all the more harshly to those who commit crimes while in a position of authority. Trust and solidarity are the bedrock of socialist society and must always be upheld. The universalist order will be organized in cells known as conclaves, each of them consisting of a circle of professional revolutionaries organized to fulfill a specific function or purpose. Every comrade of the universalist order will in turn be responsible for leading a team of civil servants and administrators so that each conclave will function as a command node within the executive apparatus of the socialist state. These command nodes will be responsible for everything from managing the provision of health care to coordinating state security to the dissemination of educational materials. Each local conclave will be responsible to a regional conclave of commissars tasked with the coordination of the vanguard's efforts in a given region. These conclaves of commissars will in turn be responsible to a conclave of marshals at the national level of the Proletarian Republic, who will be tasked with the coordination of the vanguard's efforts throughout the nation in question. Each national executive conclave of marshals will thence be responsible to the vanguard's global coordinating body, the Imperator Conclave. The Imperators of this conclave will serve as the penultimate strategists and generals of the proletariat in its war of liberation against capitalism and will be responsible for the coordination of the class war around the world in all its aspects. Each level of the socialist order, from the local to the global, will be accountable to the proletarian guard, legislative institution at the same level, and will work in close collaboration with them. The judicator order of revolutionary judges and law enforcers will likewise be made up of conclaves and organized on the basis of collective leadership. Each conclave will be responsible for coordinating criminal investigations, law enforcement, and the legal process respectively within a specific locality, region, or nation. And just as the judicator order, they will remain accountable to the proletarian guard and work in close collaboration with the legislative branch of government. Given that the guard will be responsible for maintaining public order and participating in legal decision-making in public tribunals, such collaboration is demanded in order to ensure that justice is done and abuse confronted wherever it appears within the socialist system. The executive direction of state resources is essential to the survival of working-class revolution in the face of the reactionary forces that will inevitably seek to suppress it. The universalist order therefore functions as a guardian institution of professional revolutionaries dedicated to the management, direction, coordination, education, and ideological strength of the socialist state and the working-class struggle. In this way, it is designed to avoid the fate of the Soviet Union. The universalist order, as the executive body of the republic, will not be focused on national self-interest that can be corrupted by a resurgent capitalist class, but instead will focus its efforts on winning the overall global struggle against the capitalist system.
Yeah.
To Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was actually the choir of the Chinese People's Navy, and it was the song of the nuclear submarine fleet of the People's Republic of China. So I've been talking about the political institutions that I envision for the future socialist state, or Federation of Socialist States, the Universal Republic, as I call it, in my book. And right now, I'm just going to kind of summarize, you know, what I've been talking about. So the different levels of the socialist governance in this this future political order, which I envision, you have the Universal Republic, which is the global federation of socialist states. So it really is the global authority. You know, the federal level of governance. Then you have the Proletarian Republic. The proletarian republics are the national level of governance within this federation. You have the commissariat, which is the regional governance within the federation, and you know, within each proletarian republic. And then you have the commune, which is the local political unit within each of the proletarian republics. And all of these ones, of course, have institutions, legislative, judicial, and executive political functions within each one. And just to once again reiterate what those, the executive, judicial, and executive authorities are in the Universal Republic. The Proletarian Guard is the legislative function, and it is made up of all adult citizens, basically, within the Federation. And they're the ones who, of course, determine the law. They are the basis of the of basically political, social, cultural, economic, and military power in the Federation, and they govern these things through democratic participation. And they really form the basis of the executive and judicial authorities as well, because, of course, the executive and judicial authorities are recruited from the legislative body, basically, by the first echelon volunteers, you know, people who basically volunteer to dedicate their lives to the cause of socialism. And those people are the form the pool, you could say, from which executive and judicial authorities are chosen from. So the executive is the Universalist Order, which is the revolutionary vanguard of the revolution, you know, of dedicated revolutionaries, administrators, soldiers, people who have dedicated their lives to revolution. And they're the ones who basically coordinate the building of socialism throughout society and throughout the world. And they're an international body. They aren't rooted in any one country. They are an international body, much like the, you could say, the Comintern, the Communist International was in the 20th century. And then, of course, you have the judicial authority, which is very similar to the executive authority, except it's focused on ensuring proletarian justice. And it, once again, is a international body. It functions throughout the Federation and is responsible for enforcing the law and for ensuring that justice is done and also ensuring the prosecution of exploiters, of those of capitalists, of those who abuse and hurt the people and abuse the proletariat, you know, and ensuring justice is done. And, you know, the judicator order is there to ensure that justice is done. Justice is brought to those people. So these are the institutions which I'm talking about here today. I mean, some people might like dismiss this as saying, okay, this is science fiction. This is nonsense. This is like just pie in the sky kind of speculation. But basically, you know, as I said before, this is based on the reason why I came to these conclusions, why I basically argue that a state should look like this, a future like socialist order should look like this, is based on the concrete historical experiences that socialist movements and nations have faced in recent history. You know, and the kind of repression that they've faced and the kind of attack they've faced from the forces of global capitalism. And so, once again, I emphasize the need for these forces of the proletariat on a global scale to come together politically and form this federation, form this alliance, form this union of socialist states that is capable of fighting back and capable of winning against capitalism throughout the world. You know, and I think this is a very, very crucial thing. I don't think this is pie in the sky at all. And I think this is a very, you know, this is the argument I'm putting out there. You know, this is the kind of solution I'm putting out there. You know, so with that, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a bit of a music break, and then I'm going to put on, once again, just to reiterate the things I've been saying, once again, put on Michael Parenti's talk, The Sword and the Dollar, which really talks about global capitalism and really how, frankly, for the good of humanity, it needs to be opposed and ultimately needs to be vanquished. It is a monster, and it needs to be stopped. And we need to have the capacity to develop the capacity to stop it and put an end to it. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Mein Land ist ein schönes Land, mit seinen Wäldern, Bergen, Seen, mit seinen Menschen, die ihm nützlich sind. Mein Land ist schön. Mein Land ist ein gutes Land, mit seinen Fragen, seinem Mut, mit Freundlichkeit für seine Kinder. Mein Land ist gut. Mein Land ist mein Vaterland. Dass ich hier leb, macht's nicht allein. Es ist, weil ich hier ganz zu Hause bin. Mein Land ist mein.
Classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit. I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts. Packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion, burn mics up to ashes. I make fascists clap their pants, stanzas, cure cultural cancer. I got tunes that move you to dance, burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum. Getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis. My my word, act like nominally gat, rhymingly packed, punch, crashed a fun by metric tons, and plus my math, distribute cash among the classes, take from the grieving greedy bastard, give back like short hats to get past, collapse structure, fuck facades, I destruct the support beams and bars, wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction, flip the shit just like a brick throne, dethrone kings, bring the trees on, my tone rock like Gibraltar pop, hip hop hotter than a rocket shot, I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big talk, teach you to flee from the flock, walk off, switch shit, hit my target, drop like bombs in the form of carpets, I got the target locked on that all shit, pump your fist if you know where we are. That's a rap, boom bap, original rap at, take it to back, boom bap, boom bap. Talking true path, master the craft, the pupil, the prof, keep dropping math, boom bap, blast the bazooka rap. Boom bap, original rap.
Central America, as you know, like most of the third world, is suffering from acute poverty and economic stagnation, and this is called underdevelopment. And this underdevelopment is treated in academia and in the media and by government officials elsewhere as an original historical condition. It's something that was always there. It's due to the poverty of the land, the climate makes people lazy. I learned that when I was a kid. I remember teachers saying that people in the warmer climates just don't work as hard as we do. You know, mañana, mañana, and all that. Whereas we in the temperate climates, we work hard. It's due to overpopulation. They have too many children. And it's due to cultural backwardness. These are the reasons given. The reasons given to explain poverty in the third world are the same as the reasons given to explain poverty in the United States itself, except the climatic one. But all these others are lazy, too many kids, blah, blah, the other thing. In fact, the lands of Central America are very rich lands. The lands of the third world throughout Asia, Africa, Latin America. That's why the Europeans went through all the trouble to go there to steal and plunder and settle them. In fact, these warm climates have produced ancient and magnificent civilizations back when the Europeans were still hunting pigs with sticks. There were great civilizations in places. In fact, they're more overpopulated today. They're more overpopulated today than they were in the earlier centuries before the Europeans came. So overpopulation is more a result of underdevelopment than a cause. In fact, the cultural backwardness, you know, that's a theme that's as old as Columbus. He was using it to justify enslaving people. I looked at the people in the 16th century and I said the Europeans had supremacy, really cultural supremacy, in just two areas. One was the whole area of navigational transportation, and the other was in the instruments of war and armaments and firepower. And it was that superior firepower, not superior civilization, that brought them to the positions of supremacy that they are in now. Through the centuries of colonization, there were other elaborate theories that were framed. One of the most interesting is the one that came along about the mid to late 19th century, that the colonized people are biologically backward, biologically undeveloped. They're savages. That the inferior level of cultural evolution, this assumes that they have an inferior level, is commensurate with an inferior biological evolution. None other than Charles Darwin himself. You know, I learned in school that Herbert Spencer was the social Darwinist. Remember Herbert Spencer in the School of Social Darwinism, where they took Darwin's scientific findings and they applied them to the economy. Well, when I read Darwin, I found out that Darwin himself was a social Darwinist. He had all these kinds of theories about how naturally inferior these people were. Well, how were they really culturally inferior? Their architectural skills, horticulture, crafts, hunting, fishing technology, midwifery, medicines, herbs, and their tribal democratic practices were often much better and more advanced, much more an object of admiration than anything that could have been found in Europe at that time. I mean, we mustn't romanticize these original societies, some of which did have unjust and cruel practices, you know, of their own. But generally, you know, I looked at them and I say, you know where they lagged behind mostly? They lagged behind 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th century Europe. This is the list I could come up with. Hangings, murders, syphilis, gonorrhea, smallpox, typhoid, bubonic plague, poverty, both urban and rural, slavery, prostitution, religious wars, and inquisitional witch hunts. Those areas, I would say, Europe took first place in those centuries. The poverty of Central America and the Third World, masses of people crowded into urban slums, living in utter destitution in rural villages at times, illiteracy, unemployment, hunger, disease, comes because the land is given over to commercial cash export crops and absentee ownership. It comes because they're growing coffee, sugar, beef for export instead of beans and rice for indigenous consumption, home consumption, domestic consumption. The labor and the resources of Central America are devoted to one thing primarily, capital accumulation. Especially emphasis on the labor. I gave the example once of El Salvador, where I was looking at who's in El Salvador. You know who's in El Salvador, the Fortune 500? Everybody. Cargill, General Motors, all these corporations are down there in Central America. Harvester, Chase Manhattan, in El Salvador. And I said, what's in El Salvador? Some sugar, some cotton, what are they all doing there? And they're down there for that other ingredient in the productive process, the one that really creates surplus value, which is human labor. And the Salvadoran workers are producing everything from energy rods to baby powder to cooking powder, baking powder, rubber tires, computers, automobile parts. All this is being done for other consumption markets. It's called outsourcing, where the companies go down and bring the stuff and use the cheap labor. And all those transportation costs to do that make it worth it. It's still more profitable to do that and to have those things put together in El Salvador than in Ohio, because in Ohio, you pay people $10 an hour, and down there, you pay them 60 cents an hour. So the labor and resources are devoted to one thing primarily, capital accumulation. Self-sustenance and self-employment gives way to wage labor. And that pattern is very striking in the Third World, throughout the Third World. From 1970 to 1980, the number of wage workers in the Third World grew from 72 million to 120 million. And the rate is accelerating. That same pattern exists in the United States. Back in the middle of the last century, early part of the 1800s, 75% of this population, the U.S. population, was self-employed. Today, it's about 8%. I mean, it's been a gradual decline, 40s, 20, 15, you go right down, it's down to about 8 now. And many self-employed people are really self-employed on the sufferance of some other larger supplier. The essence of capital investment is not to uplift a country or develop it, nor to bring civilization. Those are the patronizing ethnocentric rationales that are given. I mean, we do hear that the developed countries in the North must help the underdeveloped countries. What does underdeveloped mean? It means retarded in some way. You just didn't go through a certain process. They're not as capable of evolving. They need aid. They need Peace Corps volunteers to show them how to do things. They need missionaries and movies and McDonald's and Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse, especially Mickey Mouse. And cognizant that underdeveloped carries some negative connotations, the Third World nations and the UN and the Wall Street Journal and most communist parties in the world, publications left, right, and center, all now use another term, which I do not ever use in my writings. a slightly less insulting but hilariously inaccurate term. They're called developing nations. So they're just late bloomers. I use third world because I find developing to be a very deceptive term, a euphemistic way of saying underdeveloped. It presumes that poverty was an original condition. It presumes that these countries are developing when, in fact, in many of them, the conditions are getting worse. The people in these countries don't need to be taught how to farm. They need the land to farm and the implements. They don't need to be taught how to fish. They know how to fish. They need the boats and the nets and access to shore frontage and bays and oceans. They need someone to stop the chemical plants from dumping their toxic effusions into the waters and rivers. They don't need to be convinced that they should use hygienic standards. They don't need a Peace Corps volunteer to tell them that, to tell them to boil their water, especially when they can't find any wood to light a fire with. They need the conditions that will allow them to have clean drinking water and clean clothes and homes. They don't need nutritional advice on balanced diets from North Americans. They need food, and they usually know better than the North Americans what foods serve their nutritional needs, usually. Underdevelopment, what's called underdevelopment, is a condition which is forcefully imposed on these countries through history. One of the most dramatic examples is India. In 1810, India was exporting more textiles, finished mass market textiles, not just those beautiful, exquisite silks that we always associate with India. Mass market textiles was exporting more textiles to England than England was exporting to India, and more to China, and more to Egypt, more to a number of other places. In 1810, by 1830, the British had put up prohibitive barriers and blocked out Indian goods and had moved in and were dumping their goods in India. And within a matter of another 10 years, the great textile centers of Dhaka and Madras were turned into ghost towns. And the people were sent back out on the land to do what? To raise the cotton, the raw materials that would be used in the factories of Manchester and Lancashire and London. So that India was reduced to being a cow, like much of the third world, to be milked and not to be developed. And by 1850, India's debt had grown to 53 million pounds. And from 1850 to 1900, the per capita income in India dropped by two-thirds, almost two-thirds, 65%. I mean, that's an incredible drop. So we always associate India with poverty, the masses of poverty. That's not their original condition. They're not an underdeveloped country. England underdeveloped India. Ireland is another example. Ireland is a country that's not usually associated with the Third World. Well, it's the first colony, England's very first. It was the first imperialism. It goes back to, what, 13th century, 14th century, whatever. Engels was in Ireland, spent some time there. Frederick Engels, Karl Marx's collaborator, for the benefit of some who might not recognize the name. In 1856, he wrote, quote, "How often have the Irish started out to achieve something, and every time they have been crushed politically and industrially. By consistent oppression, they have been artificially converted into an utterly impoverished nation." Very interesting words. Artificially converted. And so the same with Central America. Artificially converted. The Mayan Indians in Guatemala had a better diet. They had more calories, more protein, and better conditions of health in the early 16th century before the Europeans came than they do have today. They had more artists, more musicians, more architects, more horticulturalists than they do today. They are not underdeveloped. They've been overexploited. They've been maldeveloped. The legacy of U.S. economic dominance is not only hunger and strife and misery, but an economic structure that bears very little functional relationship to the needs of Central America, of the people of Central America. The most important characteristic of the region's economy is that it's dominated by a network of international corporations which themselves are beholden to parent companies that have their place in North America, Europe, and Japan, roughly in that order, especially North America. If there's any harmonization, by the way, of these interests, it's It's with the global investor classes, between them. They're harmonizing their interests. That's what's getting integrated, not the indigenous economies of these countries. NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, is an attempt to rationalize this. It gives the total green light. It wipes away whatever political controls that democratic forces have been able to institute. NAFTA will not integrate the economies. You hear that talk all the time. These economies are going to be integrated. I heard John Chancellor, that fatuous commentator, wisdom peddler, saying, well, there was a time when we had small villages and we had to move to a regional economy. Then a regional economy wasn't enough. We had to move to a national economy. And now we're all going to have to move to a global economy. Just that's all. Simple as that. That's all it is. A benign, ordinary development. It's not an integration into a global economy, because these capital investments, untrammeled as they are, actually fragment the productive forces in these countries, any productive forces that operate for the needs of the people. Just look in our own country. Just look at what free trade and mobility of capital has done to the industrial Midwest of the U.S. We now even have a term for it. We call it the Rust Belt. That's a remarkable admission, isn't it? But it's something that just happened, you see. The Central American economies, like those in most places in the Third World, remain fragmented and unintegrated, both between each other, between the various countries, and within themselves, both in the flow of capital and goods and in technology and organization. A global economy, a world economy that has little to do with the needs of the people of the world. That's a rather remarkable thought when you think about it, huh? The other legacy of economic domination is political suppression and unspeakable atrocities. The counterinsurgency funded and led by the United States in El Salvador against a broadly based liberation movement led to the deaths of what? By now, maybe 70,000 Salvadorans killed. Many thousands more believed to have been murdered by right-wing death squads. 540,000 have fled into exile. Another 250,000 have been displaced or forced into resettlement camps. This is all one little country, El Salvador, a country of only 4 million people. So just about everybody has been directly or indirectly affected, has either suffered death or suffered a terrible loss of loved ones or close ones. The Salvadoran army massacred whole villages suspected of being sympathetic to the guerrillas. An eyewitness victim interview taken by then Congresswoman Barbara Mikulski of a Salvadoran peasant woman, quote, many members of my family were killed. I saw children around the age of 8 being raped. And then the soldiers would take their bayonets and make mincemeat out of them. With their guns, they would shoot at their faces. The army cut people up and put soap and coffee in their stomachs as a mocking. They would slit the stomach of a pregnant woman and take the child out as if they were taking eggs out of an iguana. That is what I saw. And El Salvador today in the U.S. media and by our U.S. political leaders is called a democracy. Manuel de Conceição, a peasant leader in Brazil, was arrested by the Brazilian security police when the junta ran Brazil. Police who had been schooled at U.S. Army bases in the latest methods of counterinsurgency and interrogation for his crime of protesting the economic conditions of his life and of his people, this is how Manuel was treated. For 4 months, I was heavily tortured by the Army in Rio de Janeiro and then in the Naval Information Center. Near death, I was taken to the hospital for the sixth time. The beatings had been so severe that my body was one big bruise. The blood clotted under my skin and all the hair on my body fell out. They pulled out all my fingernails. They poked needles through my sexual organs and used a rope to drag me across the floor by my testicles. Right afterwards, they hung me upside down by my ankles. They hung me handcuffed from a grating and tied my penis so I could not urinate. They forced me to stand for 3 days without food or drink. They gave me so many drugs that my eardrums burst and I am impotent. They nailed my penis to a table for 24 hours. They tied me up like a pig and threw me into a pool so that I nearly drowned. They put me in a completely dark cell where I remained for 30 days, urinating and defecating in the same place where I had to sleep. They fed me only bread soaked in water. They put me in a rubber box and turned on a siren. For 3 days, I neither ate nor slept, and I nearly went mad. This was done by the defenders of the Western world, by defenders of the free way, you see, the free market. With the aid and the training of the CIA and other such groups, victims of these military and police defenders of democracy were financed by the U.S., tortured people with electric shock. They forced victims, and this is in El Salvador and in Guatemala, Honduras, not in Panama, not in Nicaragua, not in Cuba. These are the things. They forced victims to witness the torture of friends and relatives, including children. They raped women in the presence of other family members. They burned sexual organs with acid or scalding water. They placed rats in women's vaginas and into the mouths of other prisoners. They mutilated, punctured, and cut off various parts of the body, including genitalia, eyes, and tongue. They injected air into women's breasts and into veins, causing slow, painful death. They shoved bayonets and clubs into the vagina, or in the case of men, into the anus, causing rupture and death. And I have other descriptions that make that one look almost mild, but I'm going to skip them. I think you get the idea. Yet I would argue that imperialism is rational. It harnesses these cruel and horrible and twisted impulses. It enlists them. It instigates them. It instigates them. These guys weren't born torturers. I mean, they didn't go around and say, who's been ripping out the arms of rabbits and chickens? You can come work for us. They took ordinary guys and said, we are going to train you as professionals. And torturers have testified that we are professionals. We use certain methods to get some, to elicit information, and we have to do this, and it's a tough job and all that. And the guys who finance them, who sit in Langley, Virginia, say, heck, I mean, you know, it's a jungle out there. I'm not that happy about the kind of methods we sometimes have to use, but when you're facing these tough kind of people, you got to use the same methods they do, and so forth, so on. In other words, you always justify your crimes by saying that your victim was the criminal. It's a rational process of training torturers for what is a rational set of interests. They didn't go down there for torturing, just for the sake of torturing. They used torture in order to be down there and stay down there and defend their privileges and their interests. I want to make that point because sometimes imperial domination is explained as arising from the will to dominate, an innate desire for territorial expansion, a territorial imperative. But in fact, territorial imperialism is not the dominant mode. It hasn't been in generations. Today, there's very relatively little colonial dominion. I mean, the U.S. controls Puerto Rico, Guam, a few other places. What you have today is neo-imperialism, where the country has its nominal independence, its own president and its own currency and its own police and all that. And all you do is you control its exports and imports, its land, as we did with Cuba, sugar, tobacco, its tourist trade, and all those other things. You allow them the trappings of sovereignty while you control the wealth. I heard someone at the World Affairs Council, I went there to hear a friend speak, and someone got up from the audience, there's a lot of academics and professionals and all that, World Affairs Council types, and he said, well, you know, ironically, Cuba has come full cycle since the days before the revolution. Before the revolution, the tourist trade was only for the Yankees. The hotels and beaches were only for the foreigners, and the Cubans needed Yankee dollars to use them. And today, it's the same thing. Ironically, Cuba is back to its pre-revolutionary position. There are beaches for foreigners, the dollar beaches, if you can dollars, you know, because Cuba is so strapped for hard currency. There are hotels where foreigners stay. The Cubans couldn't afford it. They don't have the dollars and all that. So it's the same. And I got up and I said, no, it's not the same, because the surplus value or the profits of the pre-revolutionary trade went to big corporations, gamblers, mobsters, whorehouse owners, and the like, generals on the take and such. And today, the surplus value that is received by the Cubans goes to the government. What the Cubans have done is they said, we have so few hard currency resources. One of them is our sun and our beautiful beaches and all that. Let's try to start a tourist trade and make that a source of hard currency. And that's what we've been doing. But that money goes back to the people and pays for their health clinics and their education and these other things. So Cuba is not in the same place. If Cuba were in exactly the same place it was before the revolution, this government would be hugging and kissing the Cubans. They'd be giving support like they do to Shevardnadze or Yeltsin or Havel or one of those people. We wouldn't still have the blockade and the embargo and squeezing them as is. Until that surplus value, until every penny of it goes back to the few and is taken out of the hands of the many, there will be antagonism toward Cuba. The U.S. policy toward Central America for almost two centuries has consisted of the three I's: interference, invasion, and investment. It's not the outgrowth of any kind of democratic national dialogue or consensus between the American people and their leaders. It's not the response to democratic pressure. It's not the result of mass jingoism, a longing for invasion or power, expansion or war, or popular hysteria. The history books tell us that about the Spanish-American War, that it was a popular hysteria. I've done my study of it. Most people in 1898 weren't interested in going to war. They were trying to get jobs. The labor movement in the U.S. had very little interest in overseas expansion and, in fact, was, for the most part, opposed. Not all. The same with the Gulf War, the very jingo war. In July 90, most Americans, the opinion polls showed, most Americans favored negotiated settlements, which is what the Iraqis also favored. It was only after several months of media war hysteria and White House war hysteria and hyping it up and pumping it up and the actual commitment of troops and the promise of a quick, easy win that the U.S. public got on its yellow ribbon binge. And even at the time, some of you may remember, I said, they're going to develop a postpartum depression. They're going to come down from this yellow ribbon high, and the American people have the habit of then drifting off into reality, and they have to forcefully be shoved back to face the harsh illusions of the ruling elites. And indeed, that happened. The conqueror, George Bush, the guy who was at a 93% approval rating by the end of it, couldn't even beat Bill Clinton in the election. So that kind of jingoism, when it is hyped up, is ephemeral and short-lived. In other words, these policies of invasion, interference, and investment do not come because we want them. I make this point because it's an important thing. I remember being at the City University of New York on a panel. Michael Harrington was on it and he was speaking, and somebody from the audience said, Michael, why is U.S. foreign policy so stupid? To Michael Harrington. And Michael Harrington said, well, we are the good Germans. We have this power thing. We are the busybodies. And we try to go here and there when we shouldn't. And he went on, and I responded. I said, you know, I have to disagree with that. Maybe the confusion is in using this word we. We don't make this policy. They do. And the policy isn't stupid. It's remarkably successful and brutal for their interests. It's stupid to us because it doesn't do anything for us. It's cost us money.